Local News, Culture, and NPR.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. And it's very live. And I'm Jason Dole, I'm your host, and I'm so glad that you're here with me tonight because we have a lot of news to get to. And almost all of it is coming from the Times Union. That's why it's a good thing that on the phone right now we have from the Times Union's Hudson Valley Bureau, once again joining me live on air, Philip Pantuso. Thank you for coming back to the show.
It's good to be back.
So let's start off with some of the big news of the week, and which we have not talked about yet here on the local edition, which is that this week New York City said it's going to stop housing migrants in upstate shelters.
That's right. This was a decision issued on Tuesday by New York City Mayor Eric Adams' office. He said that they are closing shelters across upstate, which includes a lot of motels in the Mid-Hudson Valley and Capital Region, Times Union's coverage area. There are, according to the mayor's office, 25 motels in New York City and across the state that have been used to house migrants over the past, 2 years, I guess now, a year and a half. And they will no longer be used for those purposes.
Right. So, there's a few questions I got about this. The first is, what does this mean for the folks who are currently there?
Yeah. So, what a spokesperson for the mayor's office told us is that migrants who who don't have any other housing options and who will be essentially kicked out of where they've been living will go into the New York City shelter system. People might recall that the whole reason that New York City began busing migrants upstate in the first place is because of a major surge in border crossings combined with rising housing prices in New York City that were leading to an increase in homelessness had overburdened the city's shelter system. And they needed to send some folks away. So they figured let's send the folks who just arrived here. Those situations have improved slightly since then. I wouldn't say the affordability crisis has improved all that much, but certainly border crossings have been declining pretty severely since the summer when President Joe Biden issued an executive order that essentially allowed his administration to dramatically limit the number of border crossings. Basically, the long and short of that was that when border crossings reached an average of 2,500 a day, border officials were permitted by this order to begin turning back migrants, even those who were seeking asylum, without giving them a chance to apply and stay in the United States while they waited out their application.
Something else that you note in the article, I want to mention to folks that, of course, we're going over this news that, again, just broke on Tuesday. And today is a day that Eric Adams, Mayor Adams, met with President-elect Donald Trump's border czar, Tom Homan. And the background of that is that's ahead of what's expected to be a crackdown on immigration from the incoming Trump administration. And, of course, candidate Trump on the campaign trail all year was promising mass deportation. So that's all kind of happening in the background. But something else that's there that you mention in the article is the fact that the number of migrants has been declining in recent months.
Yeah, Adams' office told us that migrant arrivals in New York City, anyway, were at a 17-month low. And so that's sort of the context here. He has been, you mentioned he met with Tom Homan today. He's been signaling that he's willing to work with the incoming Trump administration on further cracking down on the number of migrants and asylum seekers coming to New York City, anyway. Apparently, in a news conference after the meeting with Border Czar Homan today, the mayor reiterated his intention to help federal immigration authorities detain certain immigrants. This is according to the New York Times, which is actually counter to city statute saying that New York City is a sanctuary city, which means that it is actually prevented from helping federal authorities detain certain immigrants to the city. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, well, and thanks for pointing out that that was in some way codified in the city, you know, like city statute or whatever. But because I was also going to say this is contrary just to the politics and talking points up until recently from Eric Adams. So it's important to remember that this also goes beyond just what the mayor, this particular mayor, has said.
Yeah, exactly.
And at this point, has there been any reaction, especially, you know, locally, in the Hudson Valley, in the capital region, any reaction from people that have been working with these migrants, other people in the community about providing services? Is there any local reaction to this news?
Locally, it's been a little muted, to be honest. I think that, you know, when the first buses began arriving last summer with migrants, there was a major effort among advocacy groups and other supporters to give them the kind of support that they needed. It seems like for the most part, that has just continued apace. I think a lot of the migrants who came up here initially have made their way back to New York City in the intervening times. Anyway, that whole system has kind of been jammed up in various legal challenges, really, since about the day it started anyway. And so there haven't really been migrants that have been being bussed up here for a while at this point. It's not really, my sense of it is it hasn't really been an animating issue in the Hudson Valley and Capital Region recently. Certainly there's been a lot of criticism of Adams' recent shift in policy position regarding immigration writ large down in New York City from advocacy groups down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure they're not really thrilled with how he was talking today after meeting with Thomas Homan.
Yeah, and that's something that's exactly why I asked that, because I know that's been part of, like, you know, the city and national news coverage of this story, and there's a lot of reaction there, and I'm curious what some of the local reactions might be, but that's something that we can continue to explore here, because this isn't the end of this story, even though it is the end of using upstate housing and hotels as shelter.
Good transition.
Yeah, and speaking of housing, here's another one for you. You have a quick update on River Valley Estates, which I'll remind people, that's a former Foxcroft Village in between Loch Sheldrake and Neversink in Sullivan County. And the last we spoke, I'm not sure when we spoke about this, when the news was, but basically the River Valley Estates had been sued by New York Attorney General Letitia James's office. And you just want to remind people quick what that was about, and then we could say what the new development is?
Yes, this was a lawsuit filed by the AG's office in October seeking $2.3 million in restitution for residents of River Valley Estates and nearly $300,000 in penalties for the owners of the complex. And basically, this was because, you know, allegedly residents there have long endured dangerous and unsanitary living conditions. This includes water outages, sewer overflows, and illegal rent increases. The owners of the property are named George and Gayla Sue Levin. And the Attorney General had actually sued them once previously in 2018. And or technically it was called a special proceeding, but it was basically over water issues that were happening at the time due to alleged improper septic tank installations, which led to the destruction of residents' yards. And you can sort of use your imagination about what that means. But that lawsuit was dropped after the Levins promised that they would rectify those issues. And among the issues named in this new lawsuit is the fact that they apparently have not done that. So, you know, not every day that the Attorney General's office sues property owners for one single housing complex. So pretty big news. And the update today essentially is there was a hearing in state Supreme Court, and the judge issued a stay on planned rent increases. So apparently the Levins were planning to increase most, if not everybody's rent on January 1. The judge today said that they could not do that. She said she's planning to come back and issue a further definitive ruling on the rent increases before January 1, and then hopes to issue a ruling on the lawsuit in total early next month.
Is January 1st like a traditional time that a housing complex might raise its rent for the year?
I guess so.
So, I'm just trying to underscore the significance of this, because that's kind of like, that's significant that the judges say, you actually can't do that right now at the start of the year. You are not doing that, and I'm going to rule soon on the last increase that you made. That's a big deal.
Yeah, and Lana Bellamy, our reporter in the Lower Hudson Valley, was out in Monticello today at the hearing, and she talked to a few of the residents who she profiled or who she spoke with for our first story on this lawsuit back in October. They said that, in addition to other residents who came to court today, said that water issues have continued since the lawsuit was filed. There have been frequent shutoffs. There have been dirty water. One of the residents Lana spoke with said that he spent $1,000 on a filtration system in November just to try to have clean water in his house. So it sounds like the actual possibility, or the actual suit filed by the Attorney General's office has seemingly not improved conditions there for at least some of these residents who showed up in court today.
Okay. Well, thank you for that update. And of course, I'll keep asking you what's going on there, because this is a big story for our area. And the next time Lana Bellamy is in the area, she should stop by and say hi at Radio Catskill. We're not that much further than Monticello.
She could have gone and told you about this in person.
We could do that. So now a story about Health Alliance, which runs hospitals in Kingston and Margaretville. They've had to pay a major penalty. Like, how much are they paying and why?
So they are paying a $550,000 penalty, which is different than the full penalty that they agreed, and I'll explain why in just a minute. This is due to for their failure to address a system vulnerability that permitted a cyber attack last year, where hackers were able to get access to sensitive information for something like 240,000 patients I believe it was nearly 2 months. I wrote about the cyber attack at the time, and it's possible I talked about it, but just as a quick reminder, this was discovered in October of last year, and it affected computer systems at the Health Alliance hospitals in Kingston, as well as Margaretville Hospital and Mountainside Residential Care Center, which are in Delaware County. The vulnerability is apparently 242,000 patients' personal and medical information was compromised. That includes social security numbers, names, diagnoses, lab results, medications, financial information, health insurance, basically anything that you would provide to the hospital, it sounds like. And the Attorney General's office, talking about them again, opened an investigation, and they found something fairly troubling, which was that a vendor for one of Health Alliance's web applications had alerted the network that it had a vulnerability in its system in July of 2023, and apparently advised it to take action. But Health Alliance was unable to patch the problem because of some kind of technical issues. And rather than taking the product offline, they just continued to operate it, even though they knew there was this vulnerability. And in September of last year, hackers were able to get in via that same vulnerability and had access to all that information that I mentioned until it was discovered on October 12th. And then they had to take down that web application, which affected their ability to do intake and processing for a couple of days, and they had to divert a bunch of patients. So it was a major issue. You can see, I guess, why they wouldn't take it off in the first place, but there was, I guess, clear culpability on their part that the Attorney General's office was able to find.
Wow. Okay. And I mean, this is probably a question more about just the bigger process, and you might not know this, but it makes me curious in this instance in particular, like where do the funds from the fines go? Does any of that make its way back to the people who were impacted, or just goes back to the state and the common good?
It's going to go back to the state, I believe. Though that is a good question. I know, I was actually affected by this, and so I've received documentation from Health Alliance, and you know, one of the things that they offered to, I think, people who were affected by this was like free identity theft monitoring for up to a year. So you know, it's unclear how many people took that up. I mentioned earlier what Health Alliance is paying is actually less than the full fine. The penalty that they actually agreed to pay was $1.4 million, but $850,000 of that has been suspended because the facility is in poor financial shape. And, basically they came to an agreement that this is the amount that they could pay right now while continuing to operate as an essential care facility.
Wow. So that's so $550,000. That's what's left of that after the $850,000 was taken off of that. It was a much bigger fine that they agreed to and they couldn't.
Yeah.
Philip, we still got a couple of stories to get to. You mind if we take a quick break and come back for them?
Of course.
Okay, we're going to do that right now. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how the Board of Regents in New York ruled on Monday that every school district in New York must go back to teaching phonics in elementary school. We'll learn more about that. Do stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
The telecom companies were clueless for a year, maybe 2 years, that the Chinese were in their system. In other words, they had their radars off. In fact, for some parts of their systems, they never had radars on at all.
I'm Sabrina Tavernisi. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
And it's coming up now in just 13 minutes here after The Local Edition. Stay with us for The Daily. Then at 7, we get into our local music, 2 hours of Ramble Tamble with Claire. And then after that, at 9 o'clock, we got this show.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
And, of course, after that, at 10 o'clock, it's Virtual Soundscapes with Matt Hurtado. But right now, it is still The Local Edition. I'm your host, Jason Dole, and I'm still talking to Philip Pantuso of the Times Union. We still have a couple of stories to get to. Philip, you got a story about the food bank of the Hudson Valley. They've got some news on is this a new facility?
Yes, it's a massive new facility that they've been working on for a little while now, 50,000 square foot warehouse that will significantly increase the food bank's capacity to feed Hudson Valley residents facing food insecurity. So we've written about this development a couple of times. The food bank of the Hudson Valley is basically the local branch of the food bank of Northeastern New York. It serves the six southernmost counties of the greater regional food bank's coverage area. So that's Sullivan, Ulster, Dutchess, Orange, Rockland, and Putnam County. Last May, they broke ground on this new facility, which is in Montgomery. And it was a $23 million project, and it grants the food bank 4 times more dry storage space than it had at its former warehouse. This is going to lead to some new jobs, I guess. They have 25 staff members currently, and they're going to, it sounds like, at least double that total headcount. And then they're also looking for volunteers to help run the new site.
Wow. Have they said anything about what this means for their, ability to do what they're doing, which is, provide food to folks?
Yeah. So they say basically it's going to, as I said, it's got 4 times as much space. So they're going to be able to distribute quite a bit more food. And really the mechanism for being able to do that is they're going to take on additional partnerships with agencies like or with other partners like soup kitchens, local farmers, other restaurants, and basically enabled to have like more food coming into the facility. Just in Orange County, it sounds like they're going to be able to deliver an additional 1 million pounds of food. And it sounds like that about that level is going to be the increase that can be expected in the other counties as well.
Yeah, Sullivan, Ulster, Dutchess, Rockland, and Putnam, as well as Orange. So this will be interesting to follow up on maybe in 6 months, a year's time, to see what some of the changes are on the ground. Because you brought up a great point that this increases their ability to creatively reach out for food as well as also, you know, distribute it better. So that's some good news. You brought us some good news.
I try to do that every so often.
Yeah, when we can. And then you also bring me some news. Sometimes it makes me go, what the heck? And that's kind of this last story that we've got here, which is you're telling me that the Board of Regents ruled on Monday that every school district in New York must revert to teaching phonics. The first question I've got is, what happened to phonics? I thought people were learning that, but I guess they weren't. What's this all about?
Yeah, so I thought that too, to be honest, but I guess for a couple of decades now, many districts across New York, and this has indeed, I guess, been true nationally, have shifted away from a sort of phonics first model toward, I mean, it's described as various ways, but like something like a balanced literacy approach or quote unquote whole language that emphasizes memorizing words. And so I guess this method was pioneered at Teachers College in Columbia University, where a leading education professor's curriculum had called for memorizing words instead of explicitly teaching the sounds of every letter and letter combination. In other words, phonics. The idea with this kind of whole language approach from what I've understand about it is that it teaches reading more as like teaches language more as like an innate skill and an art to be cultivated rather than like a science to be broken down. You know, phonics really treats language like a science, right? And that when you memorize words and when you put them into context and when you start using language, you will also end up like learning the sounds of letters and letter combinations. But there's now a growing body of research that shows that this just really isn't true. Something like a third of all children don't actually learn individual letter sounds until they're actually taught. And this has contributed to decline in literacy really nationally, because again, this has been something that's kind of been a trend across elementary schools across the country. I think the latest figures that I've seen was that something like 60% of eighth graders in New York are not grade proficient readers. Most never catch up. And so there's been this growing movement to get back to what's called a science of reading approach that emphasizes a more systematic, sounded out instruction, as well as augmented by direct support, such as like building vocabulary and expanding students' knowledge of the world and the context in which like language is used. New York is really kind of late to this trend, but they finally got there earlier this week. As you mentioned, the Board of Regents issued this directive on Monday. It says that every school district in New York has to now begin teaching phonics again, starting in pre-kindergarten and continuing through third grade. And a lot of this research has shown that like sort of third grade, fourth grade is kind of the breaking point where kids who are not picking up on letter sounds and letter combinations really start to fall behind.
Yeah, you know, and I was trying to think of, again, I remember there was actually workbooks that said phonics, you know, that we learned from as an elementary student in the 80s. And I was trying to remember when that might have been. And the best I could think was, like, I could picture my first or second grade classrooms. They both kind of looked the same. So that sounds like that's about the age that they're looking at doing that. This is very interesting. I wonder how much of a transition this is going to be for the actual school districts and the teachers, because it sounds like this is a national transition, even if New York's late on this. I mean, people are following the lead of the Columbia University's Teachers College. Then this has impacted how teachers were taught to teach.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we'll have to be dusting off some of those old old textbooks, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and you know, it's this is coming at a time, obviously, when students are already behind and still catching up from the education disruptions of the pandemic. So that's going to complicate things. In states that have already made this change and where there's a year or two of data, what seems to be the case most often is that there is a little bit of a hiccup. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if New York State student reading scores did decline a little bit next year, just not because like this method is worse or anything like that, but just going through the transition.
It's a transition,
necessarily, is going to be somewhat disruptive.
Especially for those students that are already in, that aren't coming in pre-K, but that are midway through that pre-K through third grade.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Let's say like you're in second grade or something like that, and you've been learning one way. You obviously don't have a super robust vocabulary yet. You know, maybe you're reading at a second grade level, and now you're being taught to the rest of your reading education in a different model. So that may be complicated. But the science is seemingly like pretty clear on this, that reading with phonics and phonemes is really the right way, the best way to teach reading and to improve literacy. And so in the long run, I think it will be good.
All right. Well, I'll remind folks that these stories are up now at Times Union, timesunion.com. We've been talking to Times Union Hudson Valley Bureau's Philip Pantuso. Philip, thank you for joining us live and going over all of this news with us.
You got it. Take care.
Well, that's just about it for the local edition tonight here. But we do have some more information to give to you. So just hold on for just one moment here.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The DeBruce in Livingston Manor, New York, an award-winning restaurant and internationally recognized hotel overlooking the Willowemic Valley. TheDeBruce.com. From The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you.
Well, before we go tonight, I just wanted to take a moment to let you know about a couple things that are over at Radio Catskill's website, wjffradio.org. First off, there's a link to participate in One Small Step, and we still have some more interviews to do for that program, getting people with different political backgrounds together to have conversations that aren't really about politics, more about their lives, building the necessary connections that we need if we're going to move forward here as a country. It's One Small Step Towards Conversation. Do you want to participate in this program? There's a link to apply there, One Small Step. And I will say, because we're trying to get people on both ends of the political spectrum, we are struggling a little to find some more people who are predominantly on the right politically. So if you fit that description, or you know somebody fits that description, check it out. One Small Step at WJFFradio.org. We'd love to hear from you there. And we also have a bunch of holiday specials that are coming up. We're entering this holiday season here. So you got the Charlie Brown music going. Starting next week, we got the Retro Cocktail Hour annual Christmas show on December 18th. You don't want to miss that. We've got a lot of great specials on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Hanukkah specials on December 28th, and NPR's Toast of the Nation on New Year's Eve with Christian McBride. It'll be a four-hour special. Find out the details on all of these programs and when they'll be airing. Do keep an ear on Radio Catskill, or again, go to wjffradio.org. We have a link to the full lineup, holiday specials, from Radio Catskill. They're right there. Coming up at 7, it's Ramble Tamble, kicking off a great lineup of local music shows here on Radio Catskill. But coming up next, it's The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.